Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
I'm Stan Yogi, and this is Laura Atkins, and we are the co-authors of this new book for children called Fred Korematsu Speaks Up. And before we begin our talk, I just want to introduce a few people in the audience today. First is Malcolm Margolin, who is the founder and former publisher of Heyday Books, and it's because of him. It's because of Malcolm that Laura and I are standing in front of you today. So Malcolm came up with the idea, gosh, maybe about more than 10 years ago, way more than 10 years ago, for a book that I co-wrote with Elaine Ellenson, who is sitting here in the front, called Wherever There's a Fight, How Runaway Slaves, Suffragists, Immigrants, Strikers, and Poets Shaped Civil Liberties in California. And Heyday published that book in 2009, and then Malcolm came up with the idea for that book. And then he came up with the idea for a series of children's books based on Wherever There Is a Fight. So Fred Korematsu Speaks Up is the first in that series. And Laura is going to be working on the second book in that series with Arisa White, who's in the very back of the room, who's a poet based here in Oakland. And that book is going to be on Biddy Mason, who was a woman who was enslaved and sued for her freedom in Los Angeles in the 1850s. So look for that book in the summer or fall of 2018. And Steve Wasserman, who is the current publisher of Heyday, was here earlier, but I don't see him right now. And I also want to introduce Kimi Kudani Hill, who is sitting in the middle here. And she is the granddaughter of Chiura Obata, who is a well-known artist, Issei artist, Japanese immigrant artist, and we have a drawing of his reproduced in our book of a man who was shot at the Topaz concentration camp. So I think I'm recognizing everybody that I'm sure.
Anything else?
Yeah. You can introduce yourselves during the Q&A period. So we're going to quickly run through with you a presentation that we share with elementary and middle school students. So the book came out in January of 2017, so just a few months ago, on January 30th, which is Fred Korematsu's birthday, and is also Fred Korematsu Day of Civil Liberties and the Constitution observed here in California, as well as several other states. And we also timed the release of the book to coincide with the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066, which is the order that President Roosevelt signed, which set into motion the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans. And we didn't know when we were working on this book that just a few months prior to its release that we would have this sort of monumental election, and the lessons of Fred Korematsu's life would be more pertinent than ever. So since the book has come out, we've spoken to about 3,500,
almost 4,000
students, mostly here in the East Bay, but also in Los Angeles. So we're more than happy to speak. If any of you are teachers or principals or know of educators, we're more than happy to speak to students throughout the country, actually. So with that, we're going to begin our presentation. And we start by asking kids if they could take a guess who this is. And some of you probably know already who this is, but if any of you have a guess who this might be.
Hey, the kids in the audience, I see a few back there. Yes?
So you.
Yes, strange child sitting here to the back.
Yes, so this is a picture of me when I was 10 years old. Some kids guess it's Fred Korematsu, and I'm very honored that they think that I might be Fred Korematsu. And the more astute kids realize that when Fred Korematsu was 10 years old, there would not have been color photographs. So I explained when I was 10 that I liked to play basketball, and I liked to play the piano, which I still do, and I really loved to roller skate, which I don't do anymore because I'm afraid of breaking a bone. And usually they're kids, you know, very enthusiastic. Yeah, I like to do that too. And then I explained that when I was 10 years old, I learned something very unusual that happened to my family. And then I show this photo, and I ask the kids, what's happening in this photo? And they'll say, well, she's graduating from school. And I explain that, yes, this is my mother, and she's graduating from high school. But she didn't graduate from any regular high school like Berkeley High, like the kids will graduate from. She graduated from a high school in a prison camp in the California desert. And I asked the kids why they think my mother was put in a prison camp when she was 15 years old. And usually there's one kid who's the history buff who will know something about the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans. And that's our launch into sharing that story. And so I explained that my connection to Fred Korematsu is that my family went through a similar experience that he went through.
And then I explained that I came from a different background to this story, and that I came from a family of activists. I asked the kids, do you know what an activist is? And usually quite a few do, in the Bay Area especially. And I point out that on the left there's my father at Kezar Stadium in San Francisco at a protest in the late 1960s against the Vietnam War. And on the right is my mother, who is sitting right there, and her now wife, Jan. And I say that they protest and stand up through song. And so they were singing here, we think, at a women's rights event. And so I went on to become a young activist myself. And this is me on the left at Martin Luther King Junior High School. And I explained that at the time, an issue that was very scary was the development of nuclear weapons and the threat that brought, and that I used to sometimes not sleep at night because I was afraid I wouldn't wake up in the morning. And so we got together when I was in the seventh grade to talk about what we could do to try to speak out against that. And that then at Berkeley High School, which is the other picture, we went and blockaded. And I asked the kids, do you know what do you think blockading is? Usually they can guess, the word kind of gives the clue. But that at Lawrence Livermore Labs we went, and that we got arrested. And that there was a newspaper article. And that it says in the second paragraph, at the protest, there were 65 protesters arrested, I think, and 10 of them were Berkeley High School students. So I explained that when, you know, young people speak out, sometimes people pay attention and it can make a difference. And so that for me, being part of telling Fred Korematsu's story as an activist felt like a real honor. So now we're going to introduce the way the book is put together. We told the story in a few different ways. And one is that we wrote a biography in free verse. I'll read you the first chapter. And part of our thinking behind that, we got feedback from one librarian in particular that this is aimed at fourth grade, which is when young people study California history. But that she had said, if you could write it even below fourth grade reading level, because she has so many students, she's in West Contra Costa County, that you could write it below that reading level, that would be great. So there's sort of short lines on the page. And I'm going to read you the first one, which is called Getting a Haircut. Fred's hair needs cutting. His friends have the snazziest styles. Short and sharp, slicked down and combed back. All the rage. Up until now, Fred's mother has cut his hair. Straight, simple. Fred wants to get his hair cut by a real barber. He walks into his local barbershop. The waxy smell of pomade oil mingles with the sound of snipping scissors. Hey boy, what do you want? The barber says. I just want to get my hair cut, Fred tells him. We don't cut hair of your kind. Why? Because Fred's parents are from Japan. The barbershop won't serve people who look like Fred. Fred knows this isn't fair. He has as much right to that haircut as any of his friends. Fred walks out past other barbershops that will not cut his hair and restaurants that will not serve him food. He goes to Oakland's Chinatown, where people who look like Fred are welcome. He gets his haircut in the latest style, just like his friends.
So in addition to telling Fred Korematsu's biography, we provide background information, so historical background, social background, political background. And so the poem that Laura just read is accompanied by this section about discrimination against different groups throughout U.S. history. So I ask, you know, how many kids are of Irish ancestry, and usually there's a handful that are. And so I point out this illustration in the upper left here. About 150 years ago, this is how Irish immigrants were depicted as Frankenstein monsters. And Irish were thought of as lazy and violent, and Americans didn't want them coming to the U.S. And this illustration here on the lower left is of a Chinese miner being attacked by a white miner. And I explain how Chinese were the unwanted immigrants about 150 years ago as well, and that the United States government passed in 1882 the Chinese Exclusion Act, which barred virtually all immigration from China. It was the first time a specific national group was excluded. I ask if any kids are Mexican American or Latino, and usually there are some. And this was a photo that was taken in Texas not that long ago, showing discrimination against Mexican Americans. We focus a little more on that photo in the upper right. And most kids in the fourth, fifth grade, they are aware of segregation. So we discuss segregation and the roots behind that as well. Then we show this painting, which was done by a Japanese-American artist, showing a Japanese-American farm family being evicted from their community. This is prior to World War II, and we talk about discrimination against Japanese-Americans. And I explain that this painting is very meaningful to me because my paternal grandfather was a farmer here in California, first in the Imperial Valley down south. And he first came, this is my grandfather, from Okinawa to Hawaii and worked in the sugarcane plantations. And he really wanted to come to California to farm. But at that point, there was a law, basically, that prevented Japanese immigrants from coming to the mainland of the U.S. So he really wanted to come here. So the immigration officials were not as strict as they are now. And he basically claimed he was Filipino. And said he was Filipino. There was no bar against Filipinos coming to the mainland, so he was able to come to the U.S. and what we would now consider as an undocumented immigrant.
So getting back to Fred's story, this is a picture of Fred Korematsu with his parents, and he was one of four brothers. And we explained that the family ran a flower nursery at Oakland near the border with San Leandro. And Fred's parents came from Japan, and they felt very attached to their Japanese culture. They wanted their sons to speak Japanese, too. They brought tutors in. But for Fred, he really felt much more like an American. He was born here. He went to the Boy Scouts. He liked to listen to music and hang out with his friends. And he went to Castlemont High School in Oakland. So Japan felt very distant. He'd never been there. But another thing is that he studied the Constitution when he was in school. And he learned that he should have certain rights, which he took, you know, expected would be true. So there was tension in the family around that connection to Japanese culture.
Then this is a photo of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and usually there are some kids who are aware of the bombing, and if kids are not aware of that, I explain that Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, and many soldiers and sailors were killed, and many American warships and planes were destroyed, and then the United States entered World War II, and soon thereafter, President Roosevelt issued this executive order, and soon thereafter, the military commander of the West Coast designated the western parts of Washington, Oregon, and California totally off limits to anybody of Japanese descent, including American citizens. And Japanese immigrants at that time were not allowed to become naturalized citizens. So most Japanese American families only had a few days in order to take care of their businesses. And I sometimes bring in a suitcase and ask the kids, if you only had 5 days to decide what to take with you, you didn't know if you were going to come back to Berkeley, you didn't know exactly where you were going to go, what would you take with you? And the answers are interesting. Some people say food, and I say, well, you don't have to take food because you would have been fed in the camps. Some people say they have PlayStation, you know, things like that. But I explained that, you know, you couldn't take a phone if the kids have phones because the government didn't want people taking photos because you take photos on your phone. We show this photo of a little girl in Oakland whose family had to leave. And I asked the kids why we have this number here with the tag. And I explained that this is Fred Korematsu's family number. So each family had to put tags on their bags with that number as well as their names. And they could only take what they could carry. I also asked the kids if they have any pets. And usually, you know, at least 3/4 of the kids will raise their hands. And I say, well, you couldn't have taken your dog or your cat with you. So what would you have done with your pet? And one kid said, I would eat it. Which, a lot of love for that dog. But, you know, most say, well, I'd give it to a friend or I'd give it to a relative. But I point out, well, if your relatives were Japanese American, they would have had to have gone too. So it gets the kids thinking. But I also point out in this photo that the little girl has a tag on her blouse, like she's a piece of property as opposed to a human being.
So Fred Korematsu graduated from high school at Castlemont, and then he fell in love with a woman named Ida Boitano, who was of Irish ancestry, Italian ancestry. And they talked about getting married, and then Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, and Fred came up with a plan. Because it was only people who were on the West Coast that were excluded, he said, well, we'll leave the West Coast and get married somewhere else. And as we point out to the kids, at that point, they could not legally have gotten married in California, because a white person couldn't marry someone who wasn't white. And so he changed his name to Clyde Sarah and said he was Spanish Hawaiian and worked as a welder and moved to the Fruitvale, which we were often in Oakland schools where that's somewhere nearby. So we try to point out things that help kids really think this happened right where we are. And then somehow someone identified him and he was arrested. And so then I read the next poem of what happened, and this is called Saying Yes. Jail becomes Fred's new home. He sleeps on a hard bed, trapped behind bars. Fred thinks that Ida must be worried. He didn't have a chance to talk to her when he got caught. One day, a guard says, "You got a visitor." Fred is taken to a meeting room. A young man in a gray suit shakes Fred's hand and introduces himself as Ernest Bessig, a lawyer. "I would like to help you," he says. Fred can't afford a lawyer. But Ernest says he will not charge any money. And when we say that, the kids often gasp. He works for the American Civil Liberties Union and read about Fred in the newspapers. He hopes that Fred will fight the case against him, which will also mean challenging the imprisonment of all Japanese Americans as unconstitutional. Ernest tells Fred that the fight could take a long time, with little chance of winning, because there is so much discrimination against people who look like Fred. Is he willing? Fred thinks about it. He doesn't want to go to the prison camp. But more than that, he knows that what the government is doing is not fair. He decides to fight. Fred says yes.
So after Fred was visited in jail by Ernest Bessig, he was transferred to the Tanforan Assembly Center. So Tanforan was a temporary camp that was set up on a former horse racing track in San Bruno, south of San Francisco. And Fred recalled that his first room was a horse stall, and it still smelled like horse manure when he first arrived. When people first arrived at Tanforan, they had to make their mattresses by stuffing these white bags with hay. We point out this drawing by Mine Okubo, who was a Nisei artist, and I point out that before she made this drawing, there were no partitions between the toilets, so people had to go to the bathroom standing or sitting next to strangers without any privacy at all. Then we have this short clip.
We could try to put this, I don't know if we have audio for this. We can see. If not, we can tell you what they say.
He took me to a separate room. Well, it was a horse stall, and it was way out on the other side of the racetrack. And they took me there on a pickup. Well, it was a big door for the lent horses in. It was a gap about 12 inches down below. There's no floor, it's just dirt, so the wind was blowing through there, and there's cracks all around the wall, and there's a light bulb up there, one light bulb and on the ceiling, and that was it. And I went there and I lied on the cot and I said, gee, jail was a lot better than this.
I think the next slide. So when Fred went to join his family at Tanforan, a question I asked the kids, I say his parents knew that he'd been arrested and they knew that he had agreed that they could use his case to challenge putting 120,000 people, Japanese American people, into prison camps. How do you think his parents felt? And we get a range, you know, proud, worried. It was a big thing to stand up against the government. And I explained that his mother was ashamed, that she said she didn't want to leave the barrack that they were in and be seen by other people, and his father was very angry at him. And that it was a time of war. People were afraid. And that within the Japanese American community, even though people knew they had done nothing wrong, and this included getting orphaned children out of orphanages and going to hospitals where older people or people were sick and getting them out, but the reaction was, we're going to show that we're loyal during this time of war. So his decision to challenge what was happening was not popular. And so he was isolated. Ida, his girlfriend, broke up with him very soon after he was arrested. His family didn't support what he was doing. He was transferred along with the other people who were at Tanfran to Topaz, which was a prison camp in the Utah desert. And this picture, as we say, you can see that he's being sort of seated separately. People in the camp would talk about him, say he thinks he's more white than Japanese. He sometimes chose to work at night rather than during the day. So I explained that it took a lot of courage. At any point, he could have said, I don't want to fight this anymore. And he could have dropped the case, but he didn't, because he knew it was right. So to get the kids to think about, what would it take to keep standing up for something when you don't have other people around you supporting you?
So even though Fred's family didn't support him and Japanese Americans at Tanfran and Topaz didn't support him, he still had a friend in Ernest Besig, and they wrote letters to one another, and we have a copy of one of Fred's letters to Ernest Besig reproduced in our book, and Fred describes what it's like at Topaz and how the wind and dust rises like fog, you can't see 10 feet in front of you, we all have to wear masks made of cloth because they want to breathe in the dust. So Fred's case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And Fred thought for sure that the 9 justices, notice the demographics of the justices, would see how wrong it was to imprison 120,000 Japanese Americans who had not done anything wrong. So you can imagine how surprised and disappointed and shocked Fred was when he learned that 6 of the 9 justices said it was okay. They accepted the government's rationalization that there was a military necessity, which would translate into contemporary terms as national security reasons, to imprison this entire community. There were 3 dissenting justices who dissented quite strongly as well. One of them called the decision basically racist. Another said it was like a loaded gun waiting for another government official in the future to basically pull the trigger. So Fred lived with that disappointing news for decades after that decision.
So the war ended, the government closed the prison camps, people went home, but in many cases that they didn't have homes or jobs to return to. I talk about how children who would have been in prison basically for 2, 3, 4 years had to go back into schools again with that background. But that Fred Korematsu had an additional challenge, which is that because he lost at the Supreme Court level, he had a criminal conviction. So there were certain jobs that he couldn't get. He trained and took studied to become a realtor, but when it came time to get the license, it turned out he couldn't do it because of his conviction. So he had to work other extra jobs just to make ends meet. He met his wife, Catherine, in Michigan, where they got married. And I point out that even still, they would not have been able to legally get married in California. They moved back to Oakland and lived in San Leandro. They had Karen and Ken, their children. Now we fast forward when Karen was a junior at San Lorenzo High School. Her friend was giving a presentation on the American concentration camps. And she mentioned this case, Korematsu versus the United States. And she tells the story, which Frida Lynn, who is here, who's from the Korematsu Institute, will have heard because Karen tells it, that everyone looked at her, 30 pairs of eyes, like, oh, who's that? And she was like, I don't know. She'd never heard of the case. But not only had she not heard of the case, she hadn't heard of the prison camps because they didn't talk about it, which was very common at the time. There was a lot of shame people carried, so it wasn't talked about. So she went home and she said to her mother, Mom, who is this Korematsu? Is it a distant relative? And her mom said, no, it was your father. And you can talk to him about it when he gets home. And so she waited for him to come home from work. And she says that when she asked him about it, he said, it happened a long time ago. I was right, but I lost. And she said she could tell it was so painful for him to say even just that little bit that she didn't ask him any more questions. And then 4 years later, the same thing happened to her brother, that he learned about it at school and had to come home and ask about it.
So now fast forward again, about 15 years after Karen first found about her father's case, and Fred Korematsu is now in his 60s, and he was called out of the blue by the man depicted on the right here, Peter Irons, who was then a professor of political science at UC San Diego and was also a lawyer. And Peter Irons was doing research in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. on Fred Korematsu's case, and he discovered evidence in one of the first files he looked at that during World War II, the government's attorneys had actually lied to the United States Supreme Court in saying that they had documentation that Japanese Americans were sending signals to Japanese enemy ships in the Pacific Ocean. And the government attorneys knew that this was not the case. In fact, they had evidence of the opposite, that Japanese Americans were overwhelmingly loyal to the United States, but nevertheless, they made those arguments to the Supreme Court. So, of course, Fred was shocked by this news and also angry because he knew that if the Supreme Court had this knowledge, they may have decided his case differently. And he asked Peter Irons, "Are you a lawyer?" And Peter Irons said, "Yes." And Fred said, "Will you be my lawyer?" And Fred reopened his case. And to Peter Irons' credit, he thought it was important for Japanese Americans to take the lead in reopening Fred's case. So he helped to recruit a team of young Japanese American lawyers whose families had been incarcerated. This is one of the documents that Peter Irons found, and we highlight a salient point here. This was from an attorney who was wanting to tell the truth. It's highly unfair to this racial minority, meaning Japanese Americans, that these lies put out in an official publication go uncorrected, but obviously that attorney was overruled by his superiors.
So they put together their case, and it went to a federal court in San Francisco. And the day came, people lined up outside to get in, seated everywhere. And the judge invited Fred Korematsu to stand up and to address the court. And part of what he said was, "As long as my record stands in federal court, any American citizen can be held in prison or concentration camp without a trial or hearing. That is, if they look like the enemy of this country. Therefore, I would like to see the government admit that they were wrong and do something about it, so this will never happen again to any American citizen of any race, creed, or color." And he sat down, and then the judge, Marilyn Patel, gave her decision. But she used technical kind of legal language, which he had a hard time following. So he turned to his lawyer and said, "What did she say?" And his lawyer, Dale Manami, said, "Fred, you won. You won your case." And all these people, including people who'd been in the camps 40 years before who had not supported Fred Korematsu, came up and shook his hand and gave him hugs. And now he was a hero because he had stood up for all those years for what was right.
And Fred Korematsu spent the rest of his life speaking around the country, telling audiences about the incarceration of Japanese Americans, about his case. After 9/11, he spoke out in defense of Muslim, Arab, South Asian, and Middle Eastern folks who had been imprisoned without trial or charges. In 1998, President Clinton awarded Fred Korematsu the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is our nation's highest honor, comparing him to Rosa Parks. And I explained to the kids that Fred Korematsu is one of my heroes. I actually met him several times because Elaine Ellenson and I used to work for the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California, and Fred Korematsu never forgot how the ACLU stood by him. And so we had the honor of knowing him. The first time I saw him, though, I was a student at UCLA. It was around 1983, and he had just had his conviction overturned. And I didn't speak to him at that point, but I was really impressed with him as a person, because as you could probably tell from this photo and from the video clip that we saw, he wasn't a tall guy or a big guy or a really loud guy. And I'm not tall or big, I'm usually not very loud. But Fred Korematsu really taught me that I could make a difference in the world if I spoke up for what I thought was right, and if I stood up against what I thought was wrong. And so that's why Fred Korematsu is one of my heroes.
And then we show the next slide. There we go. And talk about how we're in a time now when people are speaking up, and there's a lot to speak up about. We show pictures, and I ask usually, and I'll ask this room, did anyone go to the Women's March that happened? So depending on the room that we're talking to, often many kids have. And so this is a picture of Stan and his husband David at the Women's March in Los Angeles. This is a picture of me and my daughter at the Women's March in Oakland. And then I say, and this is a picture at the San Francisco airport when people went to protest. And I ask kids, does anyone know why that happened? Now, we've been talking to a lot of groups that are actually majority Latino. Often they will think it has to do with the wall or discrimination against Mexicans. And I say, well, it could have been, and there have been protests. In this case, there are usually, most of the time, someone who knows about the ban against majority Muslim countries, the travel ban. And in one case, I think there was a kid who was at the airport, so we were able to get him to tell his classmates what it was like. So, and then I don't know if you can see the man with the goatee and point him out. So that's Inosanto Nagara, who is speaking at the festival, who wrote A is for Activist and now My Night at the Planetarium, which is what he's going to be speaking about, I think, tomorrow. So he's a great activist children's book author. And he took his son to the airports to protest. And I point out that, you know, there are lots of ways that you can speak up. You can protest. You can use the courts, like Fred Korematsu did. But you can also sing, like my mother. And I point out that she's in the La Peña chorus. And in fact, tomorrow night, they're having their report back. they took a trip to Cuba to do cultural exchange, but that they used singing as a way to speak up. Or that the art that we include in the book, those are people who used art to speak up. So that you don't have to be one kind of person to find a way to make your voice heard. And at the back of the book, we have a spread with sort of tips for kids. But I say, you're so much more creative than we are. I'm sure you'll come up with other ideas. And invite them to send us the stories and the pictures of what they've done, and we can share it on our website so that other young people can find it and be inspired, which is the fightingforjusticeseries.com.
And then we always end our presentation by asking the kids this question: how can you be like Fred and speak up for what you think is right? So we would leave that question with all of you, because it's not just for kids. And we say we hope that you think about that question not just today, not just next week, not just next month, but really throughout the rest of your lives, because you really can make a difference if you speak up. So with that, we have concluded our presentation. And we have time for about 10 minutes of questions or comments, if you have any comments.
We are creating a podcast, so we need everybody to speak into the microphone. Oh, you can use that. Okay. I'll run. Any questions? Right here.
So how hard was it to write this book? It's such a layered... I had a ringside seat on this one. And it's so layered, it's so dense, it's so there's so many multiple stories in this, and it fits together so well. Describe how you work together on this.
So that's, is this on?
Yeah.
Oh, turn it on?
Oh, it should be on.
Yeah, use this one. Oh.
Okay. So that's a little bit of a loaded question, because Malcolm was with me through this process. So... I've never written for kids before, and with a mixture of hubris and naivete, I thought, oh, how hard could I be to write for, you know, 10-year-olds? Well, if you've never written for kids before, and if you have written for kids before, I take my hat off to you, because I found it to be a really hard process, and there are all these expectations I didn't know about, which, to be honest, when Malcolm first asked me if I wanted to work on this, if I knew how long it would take and what the expectations were, I would not have agreed, to be honest. So basically, I was kind of flailing around for a few years. I was like randomly reading books for 10-year-olds, and it was like the range was like from Harry Potter to like picture books for, you know, with like three words on the page. So after a while, Malcolm said, let's just bring in somebody who knows how to write for kids. And so that's how Laura came in. I'll let her pick up the story.
Well, I was actually kind of a new writer for kids. My background was as a children's book editor, which I've done for about 20 years, and worked especially on books around diversity and equity. But I just did an MFA in writing for children, so I had my own kind of hubris where I was like, I've got to say I can do this, even if it's kind of new. But I had edited quite a few nonfiction books, including I See the Rhythm, that use this kind of multimodal way of telling stories, or a biography of Langston Hughes. And so I proposed the format, and then I took the lead on the biography section, and Stan took the lead on the insets. And it was a real back and forth. We had these Google Docs of insanity. and our editor, Molly Woodward, who was amazing, I say it was like a third leg in a, you know, in a stool. And then we have Yutaka Houlette, who did the art, who did an amazing job too. But it was, I think the bulk of the like work on this version was maybe 6 months of like nose to the crazy grindstone, because we really wanted to get it out for that January 30th deadline. So it was, yeah, it was trial by fire, but we got there. And now Arisa, who's in the back, is working on the next book, the Biddy Mason book. I think we're, yeah, and actually we have a few advanced peek of some of the sketches, but we just met on Friday all day, and we're right now focusing on the historical insets, and it's doing our heads in. But you know, we're both trusting that we're going to get there. And this is different because Biddy Mason was an enslaved woman who won her freedom through the courts in Los Angeles. She was a midwife. She ended up saving her money, buying property, becoming wealthy, but becoming a community activist and philanthropist. She helped establish the first AME church. She helped people who'd lost their homes from flooding. So it's a very different story, and it's bringing a whole other host of challenges that Harris and I are struggling with. And when it's done, it's going to be great.
So when I was 11, we had a oral history project at Jefferson Elementary School in Berkeley, and we thought it was really cool because we knew a lot of parents and grandparents who must have been in the camps, and so we went out, and no one would do an interview, because at that time, you know, and it was before the reparations and stuff, which changed some things, but at that time, nobody wanted to speak of the pain, and people were still somewhat ashamed of having done nothing, you know? So I think, you know, there's been a change, and I'm glad you had the part in it about, you know, his family and other people not supporting him, because I think there's a similar corollary to, you know, both events that happened in World War II in this country, events that happened in World War II in Germany, and hopefully not today. You know, will people, you know, go beyond their comfort zone, speak up when others aren't speaking up, stand up for what's right? I just think it's you know, it's really important. And what I'm just learning more recently is that although many Japanese did go quietly and say it can't be helped and don't make waves and stuff, there were significant cases here and there in Tule Lake and Heart Mountain, you know, Topaz, other people who did resist, and their stories do need to be told. And so thank you for telling it.
Thank you. Any other questions?
So you speak to a lot of children. What type of reactions or transformations do you see as a result of you going to the school and talking to them about this? Do you get any feedback of the results or like life-changing consequences afterward?
A part of what we get is actually we get to see what amazing things kids and teachers are already doing. You know, it's been now a couple of months, but, you know, for example, we went to the Fred Korematsu Elementary School in Davis, which is the first school named for him. There's now several. And we had three girls, fifth graders, who came up afterwards and told us that their mosque had been vandalized. But instead of feeling ashamed, they actually were so proud to tell us because they had worked with their teacher and their school to raise money to pay for repairs. So, you know, experiences like that feel like there are already these kids who are speaking up and getting supported, and hopefully more people in the community who are doing that. Do you want to add any other?
Yes. So just from the immediate reactions we get from kids when we're sharing this presentation, a lot of them are shocked by the prior instances of discrimination against other groups, especially groups with which they identify currently, so the Irish and Chinese and, you know, Latino. A lot of them are shocked about the interracial marriage, the anti-miscegenation laws, because a lot of them are mixed race kids. There's usually when I show the or when we show the illustration of the bathroom at Tanforan, they're like, so like their jaws are, you know, open because they just can't imagine what it'd be like to live under those circumstances. We spoke at the Bridges Academy, which is in East Oakland off of International Boulevard around 51st or 53rd, and like 99% of the kids were Latino, and they sent us thank you notes. So each kid wrote a little thank you note on a little piece of paper, and then they drew a picture on the back, and then the teacher taped them all together so they were like an accordion sort of. And one of the kids said, oh, you know, my life's ambition is to become a writer. And I was the little girl in the front who was, you know, asking all the questions. It was like, so. And then on the other side of the coin, one kid said, oh, yeah, I really identified with Fred Korematsu because my father got deported. So when we hear stories about like that, I mean, it's really live for a lot of kids.
And thank goodness for the Bay Area teachers and teachers everywhere. But there was another class we went to, and they all wanted to show us the day after the election they had made these protest signs where they had put messages, people holding, you know, placards for what they were fighting for. And at Bridges Academy in Melrose, they went out and took to the streets the day after the election. So these teachers who are trying to support their kids, but that, you know, the fear that children have now and the shock that adults that in many cases they know, people sometimes in their families who would have voted for our current president.
Feeling betrayed,
yeah. So, I mean, hopefully it's still fresh, and we are hoping we'll get more people sharing stories of things they did that was inspired. I know at Aptos Middle School, the eighth graders said they were so excited by the format of the book that they decided to create their own books. So we went and spoke to them, but they loved the kind of way of putting all the information together. And they do a whole social justice. I mean, there's a lot of great teaching happening out there.
Yeah. I'm a fifth grade teacher in Oakland, and I teach my students all about everything you just presented. And the more, sometimes I'll say, oh, I better stop now. This might be a little too much. And they're like, oh, no, tell us everything. And they want to know everything, and that empowers them, and that shows them the value of education and why they need to be educated and why we need to stay so strong together. Mm-hmm. So, and we're going to talk.
Okay. Do we have time for, how are we doing?
I think maybe one last question.
Okay, one last question.
Yeah, I guess I was curious how much exposure you're getting outside of California, because my husband and I, he's from Connecticut, I'm from Michigan. I didn't learn about the Japanese internment camps until I was an adult and when I moved to California as an adult. Like, this part of that American history is just not, I don't know how much it's taught out of California, but it certainly wasn't my experience.
So far, those 4,000 students we've talked to have mainly actually been here in the East Bay, to be honest. And it's been a self-selective group, right? It's mostly schools in the hills and private schools. So we're trying to work out an arrangement with Oakland Public Schools so we can go to the Flatland schools as well. But to get to your question, we're hoping to go to Seattle at some point in the fall in the East Coast, so New York and Washington, D.C. But, I mean, we really need to go to Arkansas and to Alabama and to Iowa, right? And, you know, if you have any, I mean, we don't have any connections. Heyday is a small press. I don't think Heyday has any connections to those states or communities, or maybe the Korematsu Institute does, so we might be able to mm-hmm. partner. Do you want to add to that? Yeah. I feel like Oprah.
Oh. Hi. So I'm the education director at the Korematsu Institute, as Laura pointed out. And we distribute free curriculum kits to teachers across the U.S. So we've distributed it to all 50 states and to 8 countries. So our hope is that we can work with Heyday to get a portion of this book into our kits that we distribute across the world, because we already distribute to so many teachers outside of the West Coast. Because, yeah, similar to you, I grew up in Long Island, New York. I did not learn this at all until I was at the end of my college days. So it's very important, definitely, to get it out of the West Coast, especially. I just feel like they don't have that, the same language that we speak here. I'm a Californian now, and I'm staying here, so So anyway, if you want to get in touch with us to work, because we work with teachers, we're having a curriculum writing institute to create more curriculum based on films and things like that, you can definitely talk to me, and our website's korematsuinstitute.org. And I'm very excited to be working with Laura and Stan on continuing the story. Thanks.
Thank you, Frida. Are we out of time? Okay. Oh, yeah, so we're going to, thank you for giving us instructions. So we do have books for sale, and we would be happy to sign them and talk to you further, and it's just to the left as you exit
right down
this door. So thank you for joining us.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.